Welcome to the Geriatric Journal Club, featuring practical discussions on the front line of PALTC issues that you wrestle with every day. This week's Geriatric Journal Club is a joint presentation of the Florida Journal Club and the Society for Post-Acute and Long-Term Care. References for this podcast and links to previous recordings can be found at paltc.org/journalclub. Support for this podcast is brought to you by U.S. Post-Acute Care.
Good afternoon, everyone. It's the top of the hour. If you joined early, you have been listening to our chat on schools and everything virtual for the last, 10 minutes. We are going to go ahead and get started. And Shane, I'm going to ask you to draw the slides. So our agenda, is pretty short today. We're going to talk about COVID-19 state of the state, but I really wanted to give more time to just hear from our panelists who have agreed to speak today and to take some of our questions to just really get a sense of what it's been like practicing out in the field, being on the ground, working with our facilities. And then we'll save some time for open discussion. So if we go into the first slide, this is just an overview of where we're at for the country, for the world, as well as the country. We know that we are pretty high with our number of cases in the United States, and unfortunately we've reached a mark for the total amount of deaths to be over 121,000. When we look and go forward, if you advance to the next slide, what that really means is that some of the slowing down that we've been seeing, we are now anticipating and projecting that we're going to start using hospital resources up again, which sort of, was the whole reasoning behind closing down some of the states and the counties that we saw across the country. Now that we're reopening, we are seeing increases, dramatic increases in some states of COVID-19. If you go to the next slide, what that means is that the projections of deaths associated from COVID-19 is gonna go up. So we're now projecting to be above 200,000 by October 1st. And that is quite alarming. I think we saw a lot of flattening of the curves, and now we are seeing spikes. In Florida, if you proceed to the next slide, if you're like me and crazy and been going on the Florida dashboard, you'll notice that we haven't gotten the updated numbers. But as of yesterday, we know that we have over 100,000 people who are positive. Where the biggest spikes have been is really in the area that I'm at, and I think Dr. Hames and Dr. Kardowski, who's on our panel, they're down here too in South Florida, where we're seeing dramatic spikes. And we even had in Miami, which has completely changed a lot of my plans, we had a lot of things shut down again because of those spikes. So as of this morning, the confirmed cases out of Miami-Dade were over 26,000. In Broward County, where I sit, is now over 11,000. So, and I think, and if you go to like just west of me out to Naples, the numbers are rising there all throughout the state. They're rising, and that's really why we wanted to have a conversation like we're gonna have today, where we are able to talk to different physicians from across the state to really see what they're experiencing and how some of these things are not just headlines, how we're actually going through and practicing, and how it's impacting our practice. So with that, I want to move it to our In the Trenches panel, and I'm going to give time for everyone to introduce themselves. As you guys notice, you're in alphabetical order. So we're going to start with Dr. Thomas Edwards. And what I'll say to the panel, please let us know, give us a few details about where you're practicing at, what you do, maybe some details about the type of practice you're in now. And like I said, we'll start with Dr. Thomas Edwards.
Okay, hi, thanks for inviting me to be on the panel. I work in the Central Florida, Tampa Bay area, born and raised here. I come from a firefighter, paramedic background. I was rescue chief for Alachua County EMS in Gainesville. I'm also still an EMS medical director, so I'm busy on conference calls with the EMS medical directors across Florida as well. So I get information from that side. I am a certified medical director in long-term care for several years. I've been practicing long-term care for 28 years, gave up my office practice and only about 16 years ago, and I only do long-term care now. My practice model is that I have a company called Integrity NP that provides nurse practitioners to facilities and other doctors in facilities, if they so choose to use, to do basically the acute visits for the facilities and the ALFs. And I do monthly visits and support my nurse practitioners from that. I was previously a medical director for a company called Health Essentials, which at one time was the largest provider of nurse practitioners, second only to the U.S. military in the United States. And I was the Florida medical director, and Dr. Stone was the national medical director at that time. That company has since gone by the wayside, and I am lucky in that through my background, I've already had systems in place. So when the COVID hit, I can change over to a home facility or a backup facility. So that's where I stand.
Thank you. Dr. Elizabeth Haynes.
Hi, thanks for having me here today. I'm a faculty member in the Department of Geriatrics at Nova Southeastern University in Broward County. So we're a physician group of four currently. We have a on-site clinic at the university. We have trainees with us every day, geriatric fellows, residents, and medical students in their third and fourth year. We also have a satellite clinic within a continuous care community locally, and we practice within two skilled nursing facilities, one in the VA system, one in a private CCRC, and my primary unit is the assisted living facility within a CCRC. So thanks for having me here today.
Thank you. Dr. Kaplan.
Hi, I'm Dan Kaplan. Thank you. I'm in the trenches here in Naples, and we haven't had quite as much action as you have there on the East Coast of South Florida. I'm the medical director and a CMD of an assisted living attached to a skilled nursing facility, which has some unique problems attached to it, as well as a separate assisted living facility elsewhere. And I'm the vice chair of family medicine here at Naples Community Hospital. It's been quite a trip here, as everybody knows, and I'm sorry about that. So now I'm slightly distracted here. I've got to take care of that dog issue. So I'm gonna double back in a few minutes, but we've worked really hard with our facility, and I've also come up with something that's kind of unique for children, because we need to not leave them out of things as far as providing some kind of hope in this really very dark time. So that's it for this moment. Thanks.
Thank you. And Dr. Brian Kurdowski?
Yes, hi. I'm a geriatrician now for over 20 years, hospice and palliative boarded and internal medicine, and I'm currently the chief medical officer at Catholic Health Services. And we have four nursing homes, three inpatient rehab hospitals, and a hospice and palliative program, and a couple ALFs. And we also have 1,200 HUD housing units for like a total of 2,000 people living in there. And so what I found out was that actually I started when the pandemic first hit, I was spending a lot of time with these housing units and ALFs because they didn't have the expertise as a nursing home, you know, with a DON and medical directors and things like that. So that was one surprise I had when the pandemic hit, because the HUD housing units were very exposed, because you know you got very frail people living in there. So I spend most of my day rotating between all those facilities, and I try to go hands-on, and I would urge everybody, and we'll talk more about as we go on here, that you amazing what you find when you walk into quote one of your places. And so I'll save more for our discussion, but I'm very glad. Thank you for inviting me here.
Thank you. Thank you all. So as we proceed, if we could go to the next slide. The first thing I want to talk and ask you guys about is around testing. And I want to start with an update that we received last week. If you would advance one more slide for me, Shane. So this was the emergency rule that came out last week from ACA. It was around COVID-19 testing. The new rule states that COVID-19 testing for nursing home and ALF staff needs to occur every 2 weeks. So that is where I really want to begin at. You know, what are you seeing as you are out of practice, going into your facilities to, you know, how do you see this being operationalized? When I read through the orders, it did not limit it to just the paid nursing home staff in the facility. So I'm just curious to see how you are processing it. And we will start with, maybe we can start with Dr. Edwards for this one.
Yeah, I personally feel like this is a compromise. It really should be every 5 days instead of every 2 weeks. So it's kind of a compromise because you've got the five intervals, the 5 days that you're don't test positive but you have it, the 5 days that you're asymptomatic but you test positive, and then after those 10 days you have you can be symptomatic or may not be symptomatic and test positive. And especially for the staff that tend to be out and younger and in beaches and so forth like that, I really think it should be done sooner than every 2 weeks. But again, another problem is who pays for it. You know, the facility is about $100 from what I understand per test, and the facilities are asking the staff to use their insurance if they have insurance. Most of these staff don't have insurance because they're not full-time. And then they're asked to sign something that they'll pay. It kind of goes by facility. So there's dilemma that I've seen in that as far as who's paying for the testing and so forth. So it's going to be a big problem going forward, even with the 2 weeks testing of how they're going to get tested and who's paying for it, and of course additional PPE for the testing. But I do think it's needed. I think it's critical, and I think it should be done more often, actually.
Dr. Haynes, anything to add?
I definitely agree. You know, it should be done. You know, our group, we're all in agreement with that. We're lucky in terms of our facilities, and I know it's very variable. They are providing staff with on-site testing forever. For ourselves, however, there's a little bit of confusion. We just had word last week, you know, that we needed to be tested every 2 weeks. It doesn't seem to be rapid turnaround time, and we were told it must be done with state-issued materials. So we were sent, I guess, toward the Department of Health to find testing. So right now we're trying to communicate and find out, you know, that would be kind of a 5 to 6 day turnaround time, giving us only a 5 day window in the facility until we need testing again, and basically, you know, dedicating a day to obtain testing. So we're trying to communicate and find out how to streamline the process. But in terms of staff, we're fortunate, but I understand the problem.
Dr. Kaplan, how is this impacting your facility?
Well, I certainly agree with testing every 2 weeks at least. I've done it on myself, including antibody testing. So I've been pretty aggressive with as many staff members and doctors, especially, as I can. One of the little vagaries that we run into is docs who go to a bunch of different facilities that are not related, financially related. So someone may get tested by the Department of Health, someone may be tested by one of the two or three companies that are out there that are private companies. Then we have to be able to get results back and forth, which becomes a bit of a problem. HIPAA-wise, et cetera, not everybody wants their results released, or they want it done in a certain way. Other times the facilities don't want to accept what they're getting, et cetera, because their home offices require something different. So we need to continue to be diligent, and I think that we're working on it really, really a great deal. That's it.
And Dr. Kurdowski, yes. Who I call you Dr. K.
Yes.
Can you tell us how this is impacting, oh my gosh, how many nursing homes are you?
Yes. Yeah. So basically, I think my staff got used to me saying, you know, the future is rapid. The future is routine testing. It's going to be frequent routine testing. And I know your nose is sore, but and you just got tested at your other facility, but you know, you might've went to Publix in between. And now, you know, that was 3 days ago. So you have to get retested. That's just the world we're in right now. So I had to do a lot of discussion with people because we have a lot of staff in the metro area. I'm down in Miami-Dade and Broward County that work in multiple places. And that was actually a risk factor early on in the pandemic, that people were bringing the virus between places that they worked. So we are, you know, just saying, and you know, unless you had it, I think we came up with, unless you had it 48 hours before and you had some documentation, we weren't going to take any previous testing. So moving to this 2 week testing is very good. And I don't know if you guys saw, but last night at 10 o'clock, and I'm pulling it up on my screen now, but evidently this emergency rule has been adapted, and they are now going to be supplying all the testing. The Division of Emergency Management, I'm reading this, has contracted with a single testing vendor, Curative Labs, to distribute all testing kits by mail and courier directly to the facilities for staff testing. So I don't know if you guys got that. This came out last night, like at 10 o'clock, of course. And now we're scrambling this morning to figure out what this means. And then they said that Curative is contracted to perform all laboratory analysis and must provide results within 48 hours of receipt. So that is good to know, because as most of you probably dealt with, you know, tests coming back 5-7 days later or after. So this is what is literally in the last 12 hours. And then I went on their website, and it appears like this testing is a, I gotta, you know, please check more of this, but I thought I saw it's a mucosal swab in the mouth. So it might not be as tough as the, you know, deep into the nasal passages. So there might be some hope there. And so meaning that's easier to administer, but evidently the state's going to pay for it. We have to do the testing, but then the results should be much faster. So I just wanted to see if you guys had seen that, you know, had come out late last night.
Yeah, because, and my question, and open to anyone on this panel, operationalizing that for the clinicians who are just making rounds in the facility, you know, something back to the point that Dr. Kaplan had made, if you're having a doctor who's going to multiple, a doctor or a nurse practitioner or physician assistant who's going to multiple facilities and they're getting tested, or how do they come to your facility, are they getting tested and then they have to leave and wait before they can round?
Right.
Yeah, so how do we-
Big problem.
Yeah. I'm just worried, when I saw this rule, that was the first thing that I thought about, and maybe it's just me going back to thinking about like the everyday practice for a clinician. You're sometimes trying to see someone acutely or doing something, or you're planning on making rounds, and if you can't take the result from the last facility with you, I worry about how that really gets.
The success of your practice depends on a support team that knows exactly how to navigate through the many variables and nuances of post-acute medicine. Based on years of practical clinical experience, the team at U.S. Post Acute Care is dedicated to enabling you to deliver the very best quality of patient care, providing a unique complement of administrative and clinical educational support services. To learn more about what U.S. Post Acute Care can do for your practice, visit uspostacutecare.com.
So let's move forward, because I am curious about the impact of telehealth. And if you go to the advance to the next slide, there are a couple of headlines that, you know, we keep seeing. And in the role that I'm at, you know, there's a lot of excitement around telehealth, but I worry about what's happening on the ground. How are we really operationalizing this for independent practitioners who are out there and may not have the capability as some of the larger practices? So I wanted to get your opinions, ideas, or just experience around what's happening with telehealth in your facilities and in your practices. And we will start this time with Dr. Haynes.
Okay, sure. Being part of a university, we're fortunate, you know, to have that infrastructure. We were provided with telehealth fairly early in the scheme of things. It was a licensing process. Our trainees are not part of that equation yet, which has been a downfall. We're not allowed to include the students or residents, but we're hoping going forward to do that. But in terms of practice with both the ALF and the SNF and with our clinic patients, it's been definitely a positive experience overall. There were technical glitches along the way, and it's not a perfect scenario, but particularly in the SNF and the ALF, where we have nursing staff to assist us with the patient exam, I think it's really been beneficial. And I think it's given me an opportunity to talk to a lot more family members. We've included them on a conference call during the telehealth visit, and we've all been able to touch base. I think more successful in reaching family members during the pandemic than a phone tag in the past. I think that's really added a positive to the equation. Definitely I'm able, you know, to have the nursing staff perform certain parts of the physical exam with me observing, but our system, I'm not able to listen to heart or lung, so that's a big downfall. But I think overall, being in a university system, it's been more of a positive than a negative.
Dr. Kaplan, the same question, what has been the impact on your practice for telehealth?
Yeah, I don't, I'm not fortunate enough to have a big university infrastructure, although I am a clinical associate professor there at Nova, having been involved with our third and fourth year students over here on the West Coast in Naples. So I've had to do it the awkward, simple way, via Skype or FaceTime, et cetera. Zoom, I'm learning more about. And what I've done is figured out as much as I can to do a physical exam on the screen. I do have the nurses, thank goodness we have nursing help. I do have them focus on the person's ankles, for instance, and ask them to press a finger, and we can somewhat evaluate peripheral edema that way. As Elizabeth said, looking or listening to hearts and lungs is, of course, impossible. I've asked the nurses to gently press on the belly for, you know, does it feel full suprapubically? Are any of the quadrants tender? And then I've done a hybrid situation where if someone is, if the nurses aren't sure, if we have someone with abdominal pain, if the nurses aren't sure if we need to send the person out, then I will switch from the telehealth and go in and actually mask up, et cetera, glove up and feel the belly myself. So that's a bit of a hybrid thing. I can do that because I live fairly close to the facilities.
Dr. Edwards, the same question. What has been the impact on your practice?
I was fortunate because I already had a couple of telehealth platforms that I had on standby that I used from time to time. So I was able to move right into telehealth. And personally, as someone who is in the age group that has to be careful, I immediately went into telehealth mode and let my nurse practitioners do the go into the facilities. So it was kind of collaborative between what they saw, and sometimes they would do the telehealth rounds with me, and sometimes it was nursing staff. At the beginning, it was very difficult. Some facilities didn't want to use, said they didn't have the extra nursing staff to be able to carry a phone or an iPad around to the rooms. That slowly got to be, we got through that. At one facility I know, they said, well, because of HIPAA, we can't take it into the room with their roommate listening, and we have to set up a separate room. And then after each time the patient leaves the room, and before we bring the next patient in, we're gonna have to completely sterilize the room. And I said, no way, that's gonna take hours for me to see my 15 patients or whatever that I'm gonna see that day. I told them that right now the HIPAA laws aren't, you don't have to worry about that. And besides, when I go in person, the roommate's next there anyway, and they are listening usually. So it's not really been a problem before. So anyway, we worked through those difficulties. Staff wise, they now have a dedicated staff member that will take the phone or the iPad around. Connection's usually pretty good. It's kind of funny that if nothing else, I think the patients themselves just like having somebody see them and talk to them, even if it's not something that I need to press on the belly or listen to the lungs, which I'll have the nursing staff or my nurse practitioner do at the time. But it's kind of funny, and they're used to looking at the patient's eye or the person in front of them. They're used to eye-to-eye contact, and they're not used to looking at a box or a phone in front of them. So they're always looking up there, and we try to get, look at the doctor, he's in the box, you know. And it's just kind of comical sometimes. And I think my wife has got a different appreciation for what I do because she's in the next room since I'm doing this from home. And she can hear, she signed the HIPAA waiver, by the way, because she is my office manager, but she'll hear things afterwards. And she said, I didn't realize that you're so sweet to the patients. And you actually, when they say, I love you, you say, I love you back and things like that. So it's helped out a lot. And I do sometimes incorporate, if the family member's at the window, I incorporate them, I'll get them on the phone at the same time and talk, do a three-way that way. So I think it's been of benefit. The one problem that I have had that in the facilities that have COVID patients, and I go to seven different facilities, they're very reluctant to take the phone or the iPad into the COVID unit. They don't want to pass the phone into the nurse to the COVID unit because for whatever reason, but they want the person to gown up and use more PPE to go in to take the phone. So they're very reluctant to do that and say, look, this patient's not having any problems. Do you really need to go in and see them because it's going to cost us more PPE to gown up and go in with you? So I kind of play that on a case-by-case basis if I really need to see them or not based on what they're telling me. The other thing, I'm very fortunate that all seven of my facilities are on point-click care. So I can get a lot of information by looking through the nurse's notes, the evaluations that have been done, their real-time vitals and labs and so forth. So it was a hard start, but it's evened out and it's gotten a lot better. And I'd like to do this continuing on. I love working from home, but I do miss seeing my patients in person too.
And Dr. K, Dr. Kadowski, if you can elaborate and also maybe talk about how it has been operationalizing us across multiple campuses. Just curious to know your experience. Sure.
So just to kind of dovetail on what our other panelists said, we were having challenges with the telepresenter also on who would be the person that would help. And we actually requisitioned the recreation people because they're much more available now because they're not running events and they're not doing anything. So they became the telepresenters. And then we ended up, Dr. Edwards, having to basically put a phone into the isolation unit, an old-fashioned 1980s, portable phone that they could take to the bedside because you're right, they didn't want to, go in there without... And so we could actually now call in. And then we also got an iPad dedicated to the isolation units. So that way we kind of, and that took a while. We had to order it. It took 2 weeks, all this stuff. But we're able to kind of break through that isolation area. And then the one area that it really helped and that we started, and to answer your question, Dr. Sanders, about we sort of piloted virtual palliative consults in one of our facilities. So we piloted because they were not able to physically come because of their schedule and their demands, and it actually worked pretty good. So the palliative consults in the isolation units was started in one facility. It immediately was making differences, and over 2-3 week period, we got it into all four facilities, kind of using the same recipe. We found out, you got to get the unit secretary involved. We had to get the coordinator involved. They made a list of all the paperwork they needed, and then that we replicated it and got it to the other four places, and now it's humming. And so anybody that goes into the isolation unit is getting a mandatory palliative consult just because of the goals of care issues and the severity of the, the illness. So that probably was one of our success stories in that regard.
Did you have to do extra training on how to use the old-fashioned phone?
You know what? You're right. I mean, what was funny was the reason we went to that was they were having trouble, like Dr. Edwards, where to look, what to do with the smartphone, what, and we actually, some of the docs went to just, you know, basically a telephone visit, which I think Medicare started paying for because they just couldn't coordinate what to do. And they were able to talk on the phone though. I guess those neurons were still there to talk on the phone and it worked much better. So I said, what does it take to get a phone line put in here? And you would have thought that was an easy question, but we managed to get it in about a week. So
now when we had a telehealth presentation on our journal club a few weeks ago by Dr. Zorowitz, he had recommended that if you're rounding in the facility, maybe do a visit from the doorway, and then the same type of concept that's with a telehealth visit, you can use that and implement that. Is that something that any of you have seen or done in your day-to-day?
I've done some so-called doorway visits. And I guess I figured finally I relented. If I were going to be that close, I might as well just go in and do the visit. So having masks and gloves and goggles on anyway, there's not that much personal interaction that's available between the patient and the doctor anyway. So I have done that also.
And you're hitting on
Dr. Edwards, I've done the same thing at the beginning before I went completely virtual. I was going into the facilities and when we didn't know that much about the virus and I was staying my 6 foot distance and talking to them. And if I had to go and press on the belly, I would and so forth. But it was such a pain when I came home because again, we didn't know that much about, you know, how much of it would be on your clothing and so forth. So my wife was having me strip in the garage and jump in the chlorine pool and so forth before I could come in the house.
Same here.
Like that, so.
So I think you guys are getting to a topic that I wanted to talk to next. If we could advance the slide. So PPE shortages and conservation. And many of you know, I currently work with United Healthcare on a national team. And just for the love of medicine, I keep a small amount of patients who I go out to see. I know that when I have done that, I had to change in the garage as well. I didn't jump in the pool, but we had this whole little pathway worked out for showering. I had to buy a UV box to travel with in my car and those kind of things, which if anybody needs it, I could tell you where to get it from on Amazon. But I'm just curious to know how each of you had to deal with that. I know some facilities were requiring you to bring in your own mask or your own gloves and those kind of things. So maybe starting with Dr. Kaplan this time.
In the very beginning, it was difficult to get the PPE. I also was able to find a spray bottle of 80% or so ethyl alcohol, and we were able to find some alcohol. I don't know if other folks have had difficulty finding it, but we sure have over here. And then, believe it or not, the Bacardi people came up with bottled alcohol in a Bacardi rum bottle that they were giving out to various facilities. So I was able to use that. I'm intrigued by the UV light, Diane, and would like to find out more about that for my car so I don't have to jump in the pool.
Dr. Edwards, how do you guys deal with the shortages and conservation needs?
Our company jumped on that pretty quick. We We were friends with several of the vendors that we had done business with before, and they said, hey, look, we've got this, we'll set it aside for you and give it to you before we'll give it to other people. So we got quite a big supply of that for our nurse practitioners and our staff people. And then learning how to rotate and you know, use them correctly. Luckily I had a mask that I started off with from when I was in I was the chief medical officer for a disaster medical assistance team here in Florida. So I had already been fit tested and had my own mask supply for that. So I was using that, but then shortly afterwards I found, I got an email from, and I should have written this down for this. I don't know the name of the company. I don't think it's really a company. It's a volunteer organization that has put together a list of continuous lists. They put it out like once or twice a week of vetted companies that have PPE supply for you. And you can go on that on their website and see the list and see how much it would cost and how to get it and how much they have and so forth. So they have a lot of PPE that was very, very cheap. And I shared that with all of my facilities. Whether they use that or not, I don't know, but we certainly have benefited from that as well. Just one twist on PPE, the thing that I want to share that I've noticed that not only out in the community, the way people don't wear their mask correctly, but I've noticed that with the, especially the younger staff in the nursing homes that I have gone into and that I have seen virtually, where they're sitting behind the desk, and I know it's difficult to wear a mask for an 8-hour shift or whatnot, so they pull it down when there's nobody around them, but the problem is they'll forget, and they'll start to go into a room, and I'll have to tell them, hey, put your mask back on, you know, and or they're wearing it down to here, and I've seen some of the younger aides that are doing, putting their notes in or whatever to the computer, had their mask completely off, and touching their face and touching the computer and biting their fingernails and stuff like that. So it's just a constant education, and I still get pushback, and they say, I know I have a habit and I can't break it. And so I think that's one of the big issues in the nursing home, is how this disease is getting into the nursing home is through the younger staff members that just aren't compliant.
Dr. Sanders, can mm-hmm. I comment on that?
Yes.
Yeah, Dr. Edwards, I completely agree that there's a big slippage in technique with the staff. And I think that's because of fatigue. You can imagine we're 90 days into this pandemic, but I am fairly certain we tracked down a breach in one of our facilities by a CNA that had the habit of wearing her mask below her nose, who became positive. And I'm pretty sure she spread it to several patients and to her colleagues. And when that revelation came up that she doesn't wear a mask properly, that just, you know, told me what, you know, I gave a vivid demonstration, you know, description to the staff. I go, picture millions of viral particles coming out of her nose, falling onto the patient when she turns the patient, falling on the computer, the same one you're going to sit down to. So all these things that they don't think of. And so we have to be, you know, and I don't want it to be like a gotcha thing, but I just want to say, oh, for safety, mask up. Everybody, I'm like Mr. Mask Up, because you're right. I'm catching way too many. So I don't know how we can, you know, when we have plenty of masks now, we have like 60,000 KN95s. It's just, I've said, we've got to use those up. I said to people, like, for the regular surgical masks, but you know, it's one of those things that they got to wear them right.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Yeah. And Dr. Haynes, how, any words of wisdom or suggestions or anything from your experience with the PPE utilization?
Yeah, I would say definitely, you know, it's been a learning curve in a couple of the facilities that we go to. And there's been quite a bit of staff turnover during this time. So I think that's been a challenge as well, and finding the time for the education. There's a lot of additional roles, of course, for CNAs and other nursing staff. So it's been a challenge, I think. But I think, yeah, the facilities have met it pretty well under the circumstances. In terms of the university, we've been fairly lucky with PPE. There was one point where a few vendors were canceling orders, you know, that had been promised due to shortages. We were supplying some of our own PPE, that, you know, in a pinch for a little bit of time during April, but staff always had access to the PPE, so we were fortunate. So right now, no shortages.
Yeah, so we talk about the fatigue of the staff wearing PPE. Have you guys noticed where you or set something in place so that they can go outside, maybe get a break to cool off or get a like fluid break, something? Because I would imagine in wearing a mask for an extended period of time that you would get pretty exhausted in that mask, you know, just from the N95 alone, but some people are double masking. I just couldn't imagine being in it for a full like 6 or 8 hour shift.
Especially if you wear glasses and it fogs mm-hmm. up.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. I mean, I would have it on for a short period of time and you're just out of breath at a certain time. So I'm wondering, is there anything we should be doing differently for the staff who, I like the concept of a mask up campaign. I love that, Dr. K. Is it okay if I steal it? Is it already published?
Yeah, well, just to talk to you about that, we, you know, what's funny is, so you're right, you want them to have a little downtime. The problem is I found them with downtime together with their masks off in the employee room. And I'm like, I go, you guys, you can't, well, I'm just having a coffee. I'm going to go, but then she's got to move 6 feet away from you. You're blowing on your coffee and so it's just all these simple things. So unfortunately I said, your break, if you want your best break, it's to, if you came in a car, walk to your car and chill out and put the music on and have your coffee out there, because you know, you have to be apart from each other and you really cannot be together. And I tell people of their own offices, they can, maybe we can, you know, you can go to your own office and take your mask off, but I said no one else. So you're right. Maybe a safe zone. I like, you know, someplace that you're right, they can take their, you know, each one can schedule their 15 minutes without a mask in their, you know, somewhere. I don't know.
Yeah, and I run through the same thing as constant education. And the other problem is because the facilities are taking a big hit with the COVID, they're downgrading their staff and they're not staffing as much as they used to. So they don't have the opportunities for a lot of those breaks and so forth. So it's a kind of, you know, darned if you do and darned if you don't type mm-hmm. situation.
Well, so let's move forward in the sake of time. If you would, Shane, let's advance to the next slide. Yeah. So insights and strategies to meet healthcare demands. I'm just curious, you know, the point that you just made about staffing and the variability between provided care within all these settings. Any insights that you could share with our audience about what do we need to do to meet the healthcare demands that we're seeing?
So we're struggling with the realization that it costs us about $900 a day to take care of a COVID positive patient. And, you know, reimbursement is much less if we can get it close with PDPM, but we're running into some managed care providers who don't want to pay that, you know, and they're paying they're not even skilling them. And so we're running into situations where, is this sustainable? And then they want us to take more. And the Miami-Dade, as you guys are watching the news, we just set a record today for the most positive tests so far, like 5,300 tests positive in one day. So so they're wanting us to take more patients, but yet we're not sure, you know, we can sustain it with you know every day not supporting those costs. And then you're right, our census is down 20% in the other beds because the ward that we made into our COVID unit takes 8 patients by the time we have donning and doffing and other areas. And we used to have 20 patients in those in that wing. Now we have 8. And those are patients that need heavier staffing. So I think, you know, we're trying to figure out how do you, you know, balance all this and trying to come up with innovative ways. I don't know if you also heard in the news that they, we asked for just $300 more per patient for the COVID patients. The state said no. And then we find out they just spent $42 million repurposing Metropolitan Hospital in Miami-Dade. I don't know if you heard about that, Dr. Sanders. It's in the news. So they're opening up a brand new hospital that they spent $8 million on refurbishing over the last few weeks, and they're going to make into a COVID place, yet they couldn't. So you know, we're just struggling. So we're trying to come up with innovative strategies. We're willing to do it, but how can you, you know, I'm worried this might turn out to be, you know, the surgery was a success, but the patient died.
Yeah.
Scenario for many institutions, meaning like we, you know, so just that's my, you know, I'm all ears to see what other people or places are doing.
Yeah. And to anyone, the financial impact of all of this has been a huge concern. How for our facilities, like you just said, Dr. K, how are we going to get them to a place of being healthy again as a facility when your census is depleted down to a third of what it normally, it used to be?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Doctor, I could say something along those same lines. I was going to say that in the couple of facilities that I've had COVID units and several patients in those COVID units, that they usually only have one COVID nurse in the unit. They're not ICU trained. They're not, I've had problems with them watching the O2 saturations in the very beginning. You know, I said, you got to watch those O2 saturations at least hourly. If they turn up the oxygen, get in oxygen units that can go above 5 and 6 liters per unit, because you're going to need it. I got morphine on board for all my patients that went into it, even though they weren't that symptomatic. When they did turn, they turned very quickly. They turned within just an hour or two, basically. And I found that I needed to send them out to the hospital because they couldn't be taken care of at the facility. So I agree. I think that what we need to do is either when we have a COVID patient in the nursing home, either send them to the hospital if the hospital has the capacity, or better yet, have these COVID units that can take these patients in different areas and get the burden off of the nursing home. I mean, even they when they have the COVID unit, they can't have the radiology people come in and do x-rays that I need, because the radiology company won't allow their personnel to go inside a COVID unit. The lab the same way. So the nurses have to draw the lab themselves and then hand it out, and so forth. X-rays or EKG the same way. They can't have the EKG technician go in. So there's a lot of barriers to having COVID units in nursing facilities. I just really don't think that in Florida we're able to handle that with the level of staff that we have. And I think it's an excellent idea to have going forward, and as soon as we can, to have units that are COVID units that we can send these patients to and get them out of the nursing home.
So in the interest of time, and I apologize because I don't think we're going to have enough time for open discussion, I was wondering if each of you could take a minute to talk about the roles of and responsibilities, the evolution of the roles and responsibilities of medical directors in our facilities, where we need to go. And I'm gonna start with Dr. Kaplan, and then if each of you could just give us like your thoughts.
Okay, I have, I guess, two separate things to mention. Number one, I had been hoping maybe to run by my colleagues this situation we have in our facilities with increasing patient and family requests for benzodiazepines and antidepressants. It's something that I've been struggling with, trying to use minimally, but nevertheless have to use it somewhat. So I realize that you've got a time issue, but if anyone can comment on that, that would be great. And number two, I think we have a responsibility also to the staff, especially the actual hands-on primary care staff, to make sure that we, number one, educate them well. And Brian talked about, slippage in technique and quote unquote, millions of viral particles, et cetera. They have to understand this. And then they have to be able to go home and take care of their own families and their own children. And for that reason, I came up with, I think I mentioned a little children's book, which I'd be happy to send around to you folks. We're gonna get it published shortly. But which just help explain things to them and their children in a simple way, and give some hope and maybe empowers them a little bit. I'm just going to put the picture up real quick. I don't know if anybody can see it, but.
Yes.
Yeah. Really nice.
The virus.
There we go. And here are the viruses. No, that's not it. Here are the viruses.
Oh my gosh.
That's so cute. Yeah, if you could, we would love to share that. That's wonderful.
So I'll get that off to you. But our frontline staff really deserve to be educated and to feel safe, because we really need them. And that's it.
Dr. Kudowski?
Yeah, no, I echo a lot of the thoughts that we've talked about today, and I think this is how we're going to survive this. One of the mental health issues that I think maybe we all, I don't know how other people's years go, but I sort of always worked like without a break from January to March, and then meetings would start, and then I'd throw in a vacation, and then all of a sudden I'm like, it's already June and I haven't taken a day off since the beginning of the year, because my normal routine. So I've talked to my staff about that. We're going to have to start being able to do that, because this is not sustainable. And so, and then where do you go? You can't go anywhere, because we're telling, don't go to Orlando or to the theme parks because of that. So where, do you just take time off? Yes. But so we're finally, kind of hitting that mental part where, I'm going to actually designate somebody other, you can't be off and with your phone on. We're going to have to take a couple days. The organization can make it without, or coverage. We all have to figure out how to do this, or we're going to be unsustainable, soon, because we're at 6-7 months.
Thank you. Dr. Edwards.
Yeah, and my plan actually is a cabin in the mountains where there is no signal, and make sure it's clean and everything, of course, and then just don't go into town and stock up and so forth and take a break that way. But I've yet to do that. But the one thing I find that as medical directors that I think we all need to do, and we probably all have been doing, is that it's evolving so fast, is I'm spending so more and more time on conferences like this, reading articles and so forth to keep up to date with everything, because everyone depends on me to give them the answers, patients, staff, my staff, nursing, and so forth, and is really a challenge to sort through all the material to keep up to date on everything, but it's a necessity.
And Dr. Haynes?
Yeah, I think communication is definitely one of the keys to sustaining through this. The role of the medical director, the attending physician, I think a lot can be done through communication, direct communication with hospitals. I've seen some problems with transfers of care, from the hospital to the SNF, to the ALF, lack of communication, inappropriate transfer, goals of care have not been decided. I've seen some inappropriate discharges. I think, in both directions, we need to look at transfers of care and keep the line of communication open. It's unfortunate, EMRs don't communicate with one another. We're all pressed for time. I think, even that 2-minute phone call directly and, groups like this, forums, physicians, grassroots or formalized groups, I think communication is definitely a key.
I thank you all. Thank you. Thank you for that, Dr. Haynes. I thank you all for joining, and I really enjoy this a little bit so much that I forgot about our open discussion. So I put my email into the chat. If any of you have any questions that you did not get a chance to answer or to get to ask and get answered, please email them to me and we will seek after the answers for you. I thank everyone on the panel. We will be back on July 8th. We're going to take a week off and we're going to be back on July 8th to continue doing our weekly updates. So I thank everyone who joined today and have a
support for this podcast is brought to you by U.S. Post-Acute Care.